in the Bay Area, and I need the correct information for our files. Well, it's not me. I've never heard of anybody named Alma Mobley. I can assure you of that. You do not have a niece named Alma Mobley who was a graduate student at Berkeley? Certainly not. I suggest you get back to this Miss Mobley and ask her for her aunt's address so you don't go wasting your time. I'll do that right now, Mrs. DePizer. The second semester was a rainy blur. I pushed at a new book, but it would not budge. I never knew what to make of the Alma character. Was she a la belle dame sans merci, as Lieberman had said? Or was she a girl on the far borders of sanity? I didn't know how to treat her, and the first draft took so many misdirections it could have been an exercise in the use of unreliable narrator. And I felt that the book needed another element, one I couldn't yet see before it would work. David telephoned me in April. He sounded excited, happy, more youthful than he'd been in years. "I have amazing news," he said. "Astounding news. I don't know how to tell you." "Robert Redford bought your life story for the movies." "What? Oh, come off it. No, really, this is hard for me to tell you." "Why don't you just start at the beginning?" "Okay. Okay, that's what I'll do, wise ass. 2 months ago, on February 3rd, this was really the lawyer at work, I was up on Columbus Circle, seeing a client. The weather was terrible, and I had to share a cab back to Wall Street. Bad news, right? But I found myself sitting next to the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen in my life. I mean, she was so good-looking, my mouth went dry. I don't know where I got the guts, but by the time we got to the park, I asked her out to dinner. I don't usually do things like that." "No, you don't." David was too lawyerly to ask strange girls for dates. He'd never been in a singles bar in his life. "Well, this girl and I really hit it off. I saw her every night that week, and I've gone on seeing her ever since. In fact, we're going to get married. That's half of the news."
"Congratulations," I said. "I wish you better luck than I had."
"Now we come to the difficult part. The name of this astounding girl is Alma Mobley."
"It can't be," I said.
"Wait, just wait. Don, I know this is a shock, but she told me all about what happened between you, and I think it's essential that you know how sorry she is for everything that happened. We've talked about this a long time. She knows she hurt your feelings, but she knew that she just wasn't the right girl for you, and you weren't right for her. Also, she was in a bad patch in California. She wasn't herself, she says. She's afraid you have absolutely the wrong idea of her."
"That's just what I do have," I said. "Everything about her is wrong. She's some kind of witch. She's destructive."
"Hold on. I am going to marry this girl, Don. She's not the person you think she is. God, how we've talked about this. Obviously, you and I have to talk about it a hell of a lot ourselves. In fact, I was hoping you could hop a plane to New York this weekend so we could have a good long talk and really work through it. I'd be glad to pay your fare."
"That's ridiculous. Ask her about Alan McKechnie, see what she tells you. Then I'll tell you the truth."
"No, wait, buddy, we've already been through all that. I know she gave you a garbled version of the McKechnie affair. Can't you imagine how shattered she was? Please, come out here, Don. All three of us have to have a long session."
"Not in your life," I said. "Alma's a kind of Cersei."
"Look, I'm at the office, but I'll call you later in the week, okay? We have to get things straight. I don't want my brother having bad feelings about my wife."
Bad feelings? I felt horror. That night, David rang again. I asked him if he'd met Tasker yet, or if he knew about Alma and the Zala Zalyer Zalati.
See, that's where you got the wrong idea. She just made all that stuff up, Don. She was a little unsteady out there on the coast. Besides, who could take all that stuff seriously anyhow? Nobody here in New York ever heard of the XXX. In California, people get all cranked up about trivia.
And Mrs. DePizer? She had told him that I was terribly possessive. Mrs. DePizer was a tool to get time by herself.
Let me ask you this, David, I said. Sometimes, maybe only once, haven't you looked at her or touched her and just felt something funny? Like that no matter how strongly attracted you are to her, you're squeamish about touching her?
You've got to be kidding.
David would not permit me to creep away from the whole issue of Alma Mobley as I wanted to do. He would not let it go. He telephoned me from New York 2 or 3 times a week, increasingly disturbed by my refusal to see reason.
Don, we have to talk this out. I feel terrible about you.
Don't.
I mean, I just don't understand your attitude about this thing. I know you must feel terrible resentment.
Jesus, if things had worked out the other way around and Alma had walked out of my life and decided to marry you, I'd be tied in knots.
But unless you admit your resentment, we can never get to the point of doing something about it.
I don't resent anything, David.
Come off it, kid brother. We have to talk about it sometime. Alma and I both feel that way.
One of my problems was that I didn't know to what extent David's assumptions were correct. It was true that I resented both David and Alma, but was it merely resentment that made me recoil from the thought of them marrying? A month or so after that, many seesawing conversations later, David called to say that I was going to have a little break from being hounded by your brother. I've got a little business in Amsterdam, so I'm flying there tomorrow for 5 days. Alma hasn't seen Amsterdam since she was a child, and she'll be coming with me. I'll send you a postcard. But do me a favor and really think about our situation, will you?
I'll do my best, I said.
But you care too much about what I think.
What you think is important to me.
All right, I said. Be careful. Now, what did I mean by that? At times, I thought that both David and myself had underestimated her calculation. Suppose, I thought, that Alma had engineered her meeting with David. Suppose that she had deliberately sought him out. When I thought about this, Gregory Benton and the stories of Tasker Martin seemed more sinister, as if they, like Alma, were stalking David. 4 days later, I got a call from New York telling me that David was dead. It was one of David's partners, Bruce Putnam. The Dutch police had wired the office.
"Do you want to go out there, Mr. Wanderley?" Putnam asked. "We'd like to leave it to you to take it from here. Just keep us informed, will you? Your brother was greatly liked and respected here. None of us can figure out what happened. Sounds like he fell out of a window. Have you heard from his fiancée?"
"Oh, did he have a fiancée?
Imagine that. He never let on. Was she with him?"
"Of course she was," I said. "She must have seen everything. She must know what happened. I'll get on the first plane going."
There was a plane the next day to Schiphol Airport, and I took a cab to the police station, which had cabled David's office. What I learned can be set down very barely. David had gone through a window and over a chest-high balcony. The hotel owner had heard a scream, but nothing more. No voices, no arguments. Alma was thought to have left him. When the police entered their room, none of her clothing was still in the closets.
I went to the hotel, looked at the high iron balcony, and turned away to open the wardrobe closet. Three of David's Brooks Brothers suits hung on the rail, two pairs of shoes beneath them. Counting what he must have been wearing at the time of his death, he had brought four suits and three pairs of shoes for a five-day visit. Poor David. 7. I arranged for the cremation and, 2 days later, stood in a cold crematorium while David's coffin slid along rails toward a fringed green curtain. 2 days after that, I was back in Berkeley. My little apartment seemed cell-like and foreign. It was as though I had grown irretrievably apart from the person I had been in the days when I hunted down references to James Fenimore Cooper in the PMLA. I began to sketch out the Night Watcher, having only the most nebulous ideas for it, and to prepare for my classes again. One night I telephoned Helen Kahan's apartment, thinking that I would ask her out for a drink so that I could talk about Alma and my brother. And Meredith Polk told me that Helen had married Rex Leslie the week before. I found myself falling asleep at intervals all during the day and going to bed before 10 at night. I drank too much but could not get drunk. If I survived the year, I thought, I would go to Mexico and lie in the sun and work on my book and escape my hallucinations. Once I had come awake near midnight and heard someone moving around in my kitchen. When I got out of bed and went in to check, I had seen my brother David standing near the stove, holding the coffee pot in one hand. "You sleep too much, kid," he said. "Why not let me give you a cup?" And another time, teaching a Henry James novel to my section of the survey class, I had seen on one of the chairs, not the red-haired girl I knew was there, but again, David, his face covered in blood and his suit torn, nodding happily at how bright I could be about Portrait of a Lady. But I had one more discovery to make before I could go to Mexico. One day I went to the library and instead of going to the stack of critical magazines, went to the reference library and found a copy of Who's Who for the year 1960. It was nearly an arbitrary year, but if Alma was 25 when I met her, then in 1960 she should have been 9 or 10. Robert Mobley was in the book. As nearly as I can remember it, this was his entry. I read it over and over, and finally had it photocopied. Mobley, Robert Osgood, painter and watercolorist, born New Orleans, Louisiana, February 23, 1909, son of Felix Morton and Jessica Osgood, A.B., Yale University, 1927, married Alice Whitney, August 27, 1936, children, Shelby Adam, Whitney Osgood. Shown at Flagler Gallery, New York, Winson Galleries, New York, Galerie Flamme, Paris, Schlegel, Zurich, Galleria Esperance, Rome. Recipient, Golden Palette, 1946, Southern Regional Painters Award, 1952, 1955, 1958. Collected in Ada May Lebo Museum, New Orleans, Louisiana Fine Arts Museum, Chicago Institute of the Arts, Santa Fe Fine Arts, Rochester Arts Center, many others. Served as Lieutenant Commander, USNR, 1941 to 1945. Member Golden Palette Society, Southern Regional Arts League, American Watercolor Society, American League of Artists, American Academy of Oil Painting, Clubs, Lynx Golf, Deepdale Golf, Meadowbrook, Century, New York, Lyford K., Nassau, Garrick, London. Author, I Came This Way. Holmes,
38957 Canal Boulevard, New Orleans, Louisiana. 18 Church Row, London, NW3, UK. Dan Lavigne, Route de la Belle Inard, Saint-Tropez, 83, France. This wealthy clubman and artist had two sons, but no daughter. Everything Alma had told me, and David, presumably, had been invention. She had a false name and no history. She might as well have been a ghost. Then I thought of Rachel Varney, a brunette with dark eyes, the trappings of wealth, and an obscure past. And I saw that David had been the missing element in the book I'd try to write. 8. I've spent nearly 3 weeks writing all this out, and all I've done is remember. I'm no closer to understanding it than I was before. But I've come to one perhaps foolish conclusion. I'm no longer so ready to reject the notion that there might be some factual connection between the Night Watcher and what happened to David and myself. I find myself in the same position as the Chowder Society, no longer sure of what to believe. If I am ever invited to tell a story to the Chowder Society, I'll tell them what I've written out here. This account of my history with Alma, not the Night Watcher, is my Chowder Society story. So perhaps I have not wasted my time after all. I've given myself a base for the Dr. Rabbitfoot novel, and I'm prepared to change my mind on an important question. Right now, maybe the important question. When I started this, the night after Dr. Jaffrey's funeral, I thought it would be destructive to imagine myself in the landscape and atmosphere of one of my own books. Yet, was I not in that landscape back at Berkeley? My imagination may have been more literal than I thought. Various odd things have been happening in Milburn. Apparently a group of farm animals, cows and horses, were killed by some kind of beast. I heard a man in the drugstore say that creatures from a flying saucer killed them. And, far more seriously, a man either died or was killed. His body was found down near a disused railway siding. He was an insurance salesman named Freddie Robinson. Louis Benedict, in particular, seemed to take his death hard, though it appears to have been accidental. In fact, something very peculiar seems to be happening to Louis. He's become absent-minded and fretful, almost as if he were blaming himself for Robinson's death. I, too, have an unusual feeling which I'll record here, at the risk of feeling idiotic whenever I see it in later years. This feeling is absolutely unfounded, more a hunch than a feeling. It's that if I start to look more closely into Milburn and do what the Chowder Society asks, I'll find what sent David over that railing in Amsterdam. But the oddest feeling, the feeling that makes the adrenaline go, is that I am about to go inside my own mind, to travel the territory of my own writing, but this time without the comfortable make-believe of fiction. No Saul Malkin this time. Just me. Chapter 3. The Town. Narcissus, gazing at his image in the pool, wept. A friend passing by saw him and asked, "Narcissus, why do you weep?" "Because my face has changed," Narcissus said. "Do you cry because you grow older?" "No, I see that I am no longer innocent. I have been gazing at myself long and long, and so doing have worn out my innocence." 1. As Don has noted in his journal, while he sat in room 17 of the Archer Hotel and relived his months with Alma Mobley. Freddie Robinson lost his life. And, as Don noted, three cows belonging to a dairy farmer named Norbert Clyde had been killed. Mr. Clyde, walking over to his barn on the night of this occurrence, had seen something which scared him so badly that he felt as though the wind were knocked out of him. He ran back to his house, and did not dare to come out again until he could see dawn, when, at any rate, it was again time for chores and he had to go out. His description of the figure he had seen inspired, among a very few of the most excitable souls of Millburn, the story of a creature from a flying saucer which Don had heard in the drugstore. Both Walt Hardesty and the county farm agent, who inspected the dead cows, had heard the story, but neither was gullible enough to accept it. Walt Hardesty, as we know, had his own ideas. He had what he considered a good reason for assuming that a few more animals would be bled white, and then that would be that. His experience with Sears James and Ricky Hawthorne made him keep his theory to himself, and not share it with the county farm agent, who chose to overlook certain obvious facts and form the conclusion that somewhere in the area an oversized dog had turned killer. He filed a report to this effect and went back to the county seat, having completed his business. Elmer Scales, who had heard about Norbert Clyde's cows and was constitutionally half inclined to believe in flying saucers anyhow, sat up three nights in a row by his living room window, holding a loaded 12-gauge shotgun across his knees.
"Come from Mars, boy, maybe you do, but we'll see how you glow when you got a load of shot in you."
He could not possibly have foreseen or understood what he would be doing with that shotgun in 2 months' time. Walt Hardesty, who would have to clean up Elmer's mess, was content to take things easy until the next weirdo happening and think about how he could get the two old lawyers to open up to him, them and their friend Mr. Lewis Snob Benedict. They knew something they weren't telling, and they knew something, too, about their other old buddy, Dr. John Dope Fiend Jaffrey. They just didn't take that normal, Hardesty told himself, as he bedded down in the spare room behind his office. He put a bottle of county fare on the floor beside his cot. "No, sir. Mr. Ricky Snob Hawthorne with horns and Mr. Sears and Roebuck Snob James just didn't act normal at all." But Don does not know, so he cannot put in his journal, that after Millie Sheehan leaves the Hawthorne house to return to the house on Montgomery Street, where she lived with John Jaffrey, she remembers one morning that the doctor never did get around to putting up the storm windows, and yanks on a coat and goes outside to see if she can do it herself. And while she looks up despairingly at the windows, knowing that she'll never be able to lift the big storms that high, Dr. Jaffrey walks around the side of the house and smiles at her. He is wearing the suit Ricky Hawthorne picked out for his funeral, but no shoes or socks. And at first, the shock of seeing him outside barefoot is worse than the other shock. "Millie," he says, "tell them all to leave. Tell them all to get out. I've seen the other side, Millie, and it's horrible." His mouth moves, but the words sound like a badly dubbed film. "Horrible! Be sure to tell them now," he says, and Millie faints. She is out only a few seconds and comes to whimpering, her hip aching from the fall. But even through her fear, she can see no footprints in the snow beside her and knows that she was just seeing things. She'll never tell anyone. They put you away for things like that.
"Too many of those darn stories, and a little too much of Mr. Sears James," she mutters to herself, before picking herself up and limping back inside. Don, sitting alone in room 17
of course, does not know most of the things that happen in Milburn while he takes a 3-week tour of his past. He barely sees the snow, which continues to fall heavily. Eleanor Hardy does not skimp on heating any more than she allows the lobby carpet to go unvacuumed, so he is warm up in his room. But one night Millie Sheehan hears the wind shift to the north and west, and getting out of bed to put on another blanket, sees stars between the rags of clouds. Back in bed, she lies listening to the wind blow more strongly. And then, even more strongly than that, shaking the sash of the window, forcing itself in. The curtain billows, the shade rattles. When she wakes in the morning, she finds a drift of snow covering the sill. And there are some other events from 2 weeks in Milburn, all of which happened while Don Wanderley, consciously, willfully, and at length, evoked the spirit of Alma Mobley. Walter Barnes sat in his car at Len Shaw's Exxon station and thought about his wife while Len filled the tank. Christina had been moping around the house for months now, staring at the telephone and burning dinners, and at last he'd begun to think that she was having an affair. Disturbingly, he still carried in his mind a clear picture of a drunken Louis Benedict fondling Christina's knees at Jaffrey's tragic party, and of a drunken Christina letting him do it. It was true that she was still an attractive woman, and he had become an overweight small-town banker, not the financial power he had once envisaged. Most of the men of their class in Milburn would have been happy to go to bed with Christina, but it had been 15 years since a woman had looked at him in a challenging way. Misery settled over him. His son would be leaving home in a year, and then it would be just he and Christina, pretending that they were happy. Len coughed and said, "How's your friend Mrs. Hawthorne? Thought she looked a little peaked last time she was in here. Thought maybe she had a touch of the flu." "No, she's fine," Walter Barnes replied, thinking that Len, like 90% of the men in town, coveted Stella, as he did himself. What he ought to do, he thought, was run away with Stella Hawthorne, go someplace like Pongo Pongo, and forget about being lonely and married in Milburn, not knowing that the loneliness which would in fact visit him would be worse than anything he could imagine. And Peter Barnes, the banker's son, sat in another car with Jim Hardy while they drove it 20 miles over the limit to a run-down tavern, listening to Jim, who was 6'2" and muscular, and the kind of boy described 40 years earlier as born to hang, and who had set fire to the old Pew barn because he'd heard the Dedham girls kept their horses in it, tell stories of his sexual relations with a new woman at the hotel, this Anna woman, stories which would never be true, not in the way Jim meant them. And Clark Mulligan sat in the projection booth of his theater, watching Carrie for the 60th time, and worried about what all this snow would do to his business, and if Leota would have something besides hamburger casserole for dinner, and if anything exciting would ever happen to him again. And Louis Benedict paced the rooms in his enormous house, tormented by an impossible thought, that the woman who had appeared before him on the highway, and whom he had nearly killed, was his dead wife. The set of the shoulders, the swing of the hair. The more he thought back to those seconds, the more agonizingly quick and vague they were. And Stella Hawthorne lay on a motel bed with Millie Sheehan's nephew, Harold Sims, wondering if Harold would ever stop talking. "And then, Stell, some of the guys in my department are looking into myth survival among the Amerinds,
because they say the whole group dynamic thing is a dead letter. Can you believe it? Hell, I only finished my thesis 4 years ago, and now the whole thing's out of style. Johnson and Ledbetter don't even mention Lionel Tiger anymore. They're getting into field work. And the other day, for Christ's sake, a guy stopped me in the corridor and asked me if I've ever read any of the stuff on the Manitou. The Manitou, for Christ's sake. Myth survival, for Christ's sake. What's a Manitou? She asked him, but didn't pay any attention to his answer. Some story about an Indian who chased a deer for days up a mountain, but when he got to the top, the deer turned on him and wasn't a deer anymore. And bundled up Ricky Hawthorne, driving to Wheat Row one morning, he now had his snow tires, saw a man wearing a pea jacket and a blue watch cap beating a child on the north side of the square. He slowed and just had time to see the boy's bare feet kicking in the snow. For a moment he was so shocked that he could not think what to do. But he stopped, pulling the car over to the curb and got out.
"That's enough," he shouted. "That's quite enough."
But the man and the child both turned to stare at him with such peculiar force that he put down his arm and got back in the car. And the next night, sipping chamomile tea, looking out of an upstairs window and nearly dropping the cup, seeing a forlorn face staring in at him, gone in an instant when he jerked to one side. In the next instant, he realized it was his own face. And Peter Barnes and Jim Hardy come out of a country bar, and Jim, who was only half as drunk as Peter, says,
"Hey, shithead, I got a great idea,"
and laughs most of the way back to Milburn. And a dark-haired woman sits facing the window in a dark room in the Archer Hotel and watches the snowfall and smiles to herself. And at 6:30 in the evening, an insurance salesman named Freddie Robinson locks himself in his den and telephones a receptionist named Florence Quast and says,
"No, I don't think I need to bother either of them. I think that new girl of theirs could answer my questions. Could you give me her name and just where she's staying again?"
And the woman in the hotel sits and smiles, and several more animals, part of the fun, are butchered. Two heifers in Elmer Scales's barn, Elmer having fallen asleep with a shotgun across his lap, and one of the Dedham girls' horses. 2. That was how Freddie Robinson came in. He had written the policy for the two Dedham girls, the daughters of the late Colonel and the sisters of long-deceased Stringer Dedham. Nobody bothered about the Dedham girls much anymore. They lived out in their old house on Willow Mile Road. They had their horses, but rarely sold one. They kept to themselves. The same age as most of the men in the Chowder Society, they had not aged as well. For years they had talked obsessionally about Stringer, who had not died immediately when the threshing machine pulled off his arms, but had lain on the kitchen table, wrapped in three blankets during a sweltering August, babbling and passing out and then babbling again, until the life ran out of him. People in Milburn got tired of hearing about what Stringer was trying to say while he died, especially since it didn't make much sense. Even the Dedham girls couldn't properly explain it. What they wanted you to know was that Stringer had seen something. He was upset. He wasn't fool enough to get caught in the thresher if he was really himself, was he? And the girls seemed to blame Stringer's fiancée, Miss Galley, and for a little while eyebrows were raised at her. But then Miss Galley just upped and left town, and after that people lost interest in whatever the Dedham girls thought of her. 30 years later, not many people in town even remembered Stringer Dedham, who had been handsome and a gentleman, and would have turned the horses into a business and not just a half-hearted hobby for a couple of aging women. And the Dedham girls got tired of their own obsession. After so many years, they weren't so sure what Stringer had been trying to say about Miss Galley, and decided that their horses were better friends than Milburn people. 20 years after that, they were still alive. But Nettie was paralyzed with a stroke, and most young people in Milburn had never seen either of them. Freddie Robinson had driven past their farm one day not long after he had moved to Milburn, and what made him reverse and go up the drive was the name on the mailbox, Colonel T. Dedham. He didn't know that Rhea Dedham repainted her father's name on the box every 2 years. Even though Colonel Thomas Dedham had died of malaria in 1910, she was too superstitious to take it off. Rhea explained it to him, and she was so pleased to have a spruce young man across the table from her that she bought $3,000 worth of insurance. What she insured were her horses. She was thinking of Jim Hardy, but she didn't tell that to Freddie Robinson. Jim Hardy was a bad'un, and he'd had a grudge against the girls ever since Rhea shooed him away from the horse barn when he was a little boy. The way young Robinson explained it to her, a little insurance was just what she needed, in case Jim Hardy ever came back with a can of gasoline and a match. At the time, Freddie was a new agent, and his ambition was to become a member of the Million Dollar Round Table. 8 years later, he was close to making it, but it no longer mattered to him. He knew that if he'd been in a bigger town, he'd have had it long before. He had been to enough conferences and conventions and sales meetings to think that he knew most that there was to know about the insurance business. He knew how the business worked, and he knew just how to sell life and property insurance to a scared young farmer whose soul belonged to the bank and whose nest egg had just vanished into a new milking system. Now a fellow like that really needed insurance. But 8 years of living in Milburn had changed Freddie Robinson. He no longer took pride in his ability to sell, since he had learned that it was based on an ability to exploit fear and greed. And he had learned, half-consciously, to despise most of his fellow salesmen, in the company's phrase, the humdingers. It was not his marriage or children which had changed Freddie, but living across the street from John Jaffrey's house. At first, he had thought that the old boys he saw trooping in once a month or so were comic, unbelievably stuffy-looking. Dinner jackets. They had looked unprecedentedly grave. 5 Methuselahs padding out their time. Then he began to notice that after sales meetings in New York, he returned home with relief. His marriage was going badly. He was finding himself attracted to the high school girls his wife, 2 children ago, had rather resembled. But home was more than Montgomery Street. It was all of Milburn, and most of Milburn was quieter and prettier than anywhere he'd ever lived. Gradually he felt that he had a secret relationship to Milburn. His wife and children were eternal, but Milburn was a temporary, restful oasis, not the provincial backwater he had first thought it. And, once at a conference, a new agent sitting next to him unpinned his humdinger badge and dropped it under the table, saying, "I can stand most of it, but this Mickey Mouse crap drives me up the wall." 2 further events, as unremarkable as these, assisted Freddie's conversion. One night, aimlessly walking about an ordinary section of Milburn, he went past Edward Wanderley's house on Haven Lane and saw the Chowder Society through a window. There they sat, his Methuselahs, talking among themselves. One raised a hand, one smiled.
Freddy was lonely, and they seemed very close. He stopped to stare in at them. Since moving to Milburn, he had gone from 26 to 31, and the men no longer seemed so old. While they had stayed the same, he had aged toward them. They were not grotesque, but dignified. Also, something he had never considered, they were enjoying themselves. He wondered what they were talking about, and was assailed by the sense that it was something secret, something not business, not sport, not sex, not politics. It simply washed through him that their conversation would be a sort he had never heard. 2 weeks later, he took one of the high school girls to a restaurant in Binghamton and saw Louis Benedict across the room with one of the waitresses from Humphrey Stallage's bar. Both had sweetly rejected Freddy's advances. He had begun to envy the Chowder Society. Before long, he would begin to love what he considered they represented, a way of combining civilization with a quiet good time. Louis was the focus of Freddy's feelings. Closer to Freddy's age than the others, he showed what Freddy might become. He watched his idol at Humphrey's place, noticing how he raised his eyebrows before answering a question, and how he tilted his head to one side, often when smiling, how he used his eyes. Freddy began to copy these mannerisms. He copied, too, what he thought was Louis's sexual pattern, but scaling down the ages of the girls from Louis's 25 or 26 to 17 or 18, which was the age of the girls who interested him anyhow. He bought jackets like those he saw Louis wearing. When Dr. Jaffrey invited him to his party for Ann Veronica Moore, Freddy thought the doors of heaven had opened. He pictured a quiet evening, the Chowder Society and himself and the actress, and told his wife to stay home. When he saw the crowd, he began behaving like a fool. He stayed downstairs, too shy and disappointed to approach the older men he wanted to befriend. He had made eyes at Stella Hawthorne. When he finally gathered the nerve to approach Sears James, who had always terrified him, he found himself talking about insurance, as if under a curse. After Edward Wanderley's body was discovered, Freddy crawled away with the other guests. After Dr. Jaffrey's suicide, Freddy was desperate. The Chowder Society was disintegrating before he had even had a chance to prove his worthiness for it. On that night, he saw Louis's Morgan pull up to the doctor's house and ran out to comfort Louis, to make his impression. But again, it had not worked. He was too nervous. He had been fighting with his wife, and he had been unable to keep from mentioning insurance. He had lost Louis again. Therefore, knowing nothing of what Stringer Dedham may have tried to describe to his sisters as he lay bleeding to death into a blanket on his kitchen table, Freddy Robinson, whose children were already noisy strangers and whose wife wanted a divorce, had no idea of what lay before him when Rhea Dedham called him one morning and said that he had to come out to the farm. But he thought that what he saw there, a bit of a silk scarf fluttering on a wire fence, gave him away into the gracious company of friends he needed. At first, it seemed like another morning's work, another tiresome claim to be settled. Rhea Dedham made him wait 10 minutes on her frozen porch. From time to time, he heard a horse neighing in the stables. Finally, she appeared, wrinkled and hunched in a plaid shawl over her dress, saying that she knew who did it. Yes, sir, she knew. But she'd looked at her policy, and it didn't say anywhere that you didn't get your money if you knew, did it? And would he like any coffee? Yes, thank you, Freddy said, and pulled some papers from his briefcase.
Now, if we could get into some of these claim forms, the company can start processing them as soon as possible. I'll have to look at the damage, of course, Miss Dedham. I guess you had some kind of accident?
I told you, she said. I know who did it. It wasn't any accident. Mr. Hardesty is coming out, too, so you'll just have to wait for him.
So this is a case of criminal loss, Freddy said, checking off a box on one of his papers. Could you just tell me about it in your own words?
They're the only words I have, Mr. Robinson. But you'll wait until Mr. Hardesty is here. I'm too old to say it all twice. And I'm not going out in that cold twice, not even for money.
Brr!
She hugged herself with her bony arms and shivered theatrically.
Now you sit still and get some coffee into yourself.
Freddy, who had been awkwardly holding all his papers, his pen, and his briefcase, looking around for a vacant chair. The Dedham girls' kitchen was a dirty cave filled with junk. One chair supported a couple of table lamps, another a stack of urbanites so old they were yellow. A tall mirror in an oak leaf frame on one wall dully gave him back his reflection, a figure of bureaucratic incompetence engulfed by disorderly papers. He backed up to one dark wall, bent down, and knocked a cardboard box off a chair with his bottom. It fell to the floor with a loud crash. The only sunlight in the room streamed over him.
"Heavens!" Rhea Dedham said, shrugging. "Noise!"
Freddy cautiously extended his legs and arranged his papers on his lap.
"Dead horse, is that it?"
"That's it. You people owe me some money. A lot of money, the way I see it."
Freddy heard something heavy rolling toward the kitchen through the house and soundlessly groaned.
"I'll just get started on the preliminary details," he said, and bent over so that he would not have to look at Nettie Dedham.
"Nettie wants to say hello," Rhea said.
So he had to look up anyhow. A moment later, the door creaked inward, admitting a heap of blankets and a wheelchair.
"Hello, Miss Dedham," Freddy said, half standing and clutching the briefcase with one hand, the papers with the other. He gave her a quick glance, then fled back into his papers.
Nettie uttered a noise. Her head seemed to Freddy to be chiefly gaping mouth. Nettie was covered up to the chin in blankets, and her head was pulled back by some terrible constriction of the muscles, so that her mouth was permanently open.
"You remember nice Mr. Robinson,"
Rhea said to her sister, putting down cups of coffee on the table. Rhea apparently ate all her meals standing up, for she made no move to sit down.
"He's going to get our money for our poor dear chocolate. He's filling out the forms now, isn't he? He's filling out the forms."
Nettie uttered, waggling her head as she spoke.
"Get us our money, that's right," Rhea said. "There's nothing wrong with Nettie, Mr. Robinson."
"I should say not," he said, and looked away again. His eye fell on a stuffed robin under a glass bell, surrounded by dark brown leaves. "Let's get down to business, shall we? I gather the animal was named..."
"Here's Mr. Hardesty," Rhea said.
Freddy could hear another car coming up the drive, and lay the pen across the papers in his lap. He glanced uneasily at Nettie, who was working her mouth and staring dreamily at the mottled ceiling. Rhea set down her cup and began to struggle toward the door.
Lewis would open it for her, he thought, still clutching his awkward pile of papers.
"Sit down, for heaven's sake," the old woman snapped.
Hardesty's boots crunched across the snow, mounted the porch. He had knocked twice before Rhea got to the door. Freddy had seen Walt Hardesty in Humphrey's place too often, sneaking into the back room at 8 and lurching out at 12 to think much of him as a sheriff.
He looked like a bad-tempered failure, the sort of cop who'd enjoy using his gun butt on someone's head. When Rhea got the door open, Hardesty stood on the porch with his hands in his pockets, his sunglasses like armor over his eyes, and made no move to come in.
"Hello, Miss Dedham," he said. "Well, where's your problem?"
Rhea pulled the shawl more tightly around herself and went through the door. Freddy hesitated a moment and then realized that she was not coming back in. He dumped his papers on the chair and followed. Nettie waggled her head at him as he passed.
"I know who did it,"
he heard her saying to Hardesty as he went toward them. The old lady's voice was high and indignant.
"It was that Jim Hardy, that's who."
Yeah, Hardesty said. Freddy joined them, and the sheriff nodded at him over Rhea's head.
"Didn't take you long to get here, Mr. Robinson."
"Company paperwork," Freddy mumbled. "Official paperwork."
"Guys like you always got papers up the old kazoo," Hardesty said, and gave him a taut smile.
"It was Jim Hardy for sure," Rhea insisted. "That boy's crazy."
"Well, we'll see about that," Hardesty said. They were nearly at the stables. "You find the dead animal?"
"We have a boy these days," Rhea said. "He comes out to feed and water and change the straw. He's a Nancy boy," she added,
and Freddy jerked his head up in surprise. Now he could smell the stables.
"He found chocolate in his stall. That's $600 worth of horse meat, Mr. Robinson, no matter who did it."
How did you reach that figure?" Freddy asked. Hardesty was opening the stable doors. One horse whinnied, another kicked at its stall door. All the horses, to Freddy's untrained eye, looked dangerous. Their enormous lips and eyes flared at him.
"Because his sire was General Hershey, and his dam was Sweet Tooth, and they were two fine horses. That's because why. We could have sold General Hershey for stud anywhere. He looked just like Seabiscuit, Nettie used to say."
"Seabiscuit," Hardy said under his breath.
"You're too young to remember any of the good horses," Rhea said. "You write that down in your papers, $600.
She was leading them into the stables, and the horses in the stalls shied back or swung their heads according to their nature.
"These animals ain't too damn clean," Hardesty said.
Freddy looked more closely and saw a huge patch of dried mud on the side of a gray.
"Skittish," Freddy said. "He says they're skittish. The other one says they're dirty. I'm too old. That's the problem. Well, here's poor old Chocolate."
The statement was unnecessary. The two men were staring over the stall door at the body of a big, reddish animal on the straw-littered floor. To Freddy, it looked like the body of a huge rat.
"Hell," Hardesty said, and opened the stall door.
He stepped over the stiff legs and began to straddle the neck. The horse in the next stall whinnied, and Hardesty nearly fell down.
"Hell!"
He steadied himself by propping an arm against the wooden side of the stall.
"Hell, I can't see it from here."
He reached down to the horse's nose and tugged the entire head back toward him. Rhea Dedham screamed. The two men half-carried, half-lifted her out of the stables past two rows of terrified horses.
"Settle down now, settle down,"
Hardesty kept repeating, as if the old lady were herself a horse.
"Who the hell would do a thing like that?" Freddy asked, still shocked by the sight of the long wound in the horse's neck.
"Norbert Clyde claims it's Martians. Says he saw one. Didn't you hear about that?"
"I heard something," Freddy admitted. "Are you going to check into where Jim Hardy was last night?"
"Mister, I'd be a damn sight happier if people didn't tell me how to do my job."
He bent over the old woman.
"Miss Dedham, you settled down now.
You like to sit? She nodded, and Hardesty said to Freddy, I'll hold her up. You open the door of my car. They propped her up on the car seat, her legs dangling out.
Poor chocolate, she moaned. Horrible, poor chocolate.
All right, Miss Dedham. Now I want to tell you something. Hardesty leaned forward and propped a foot up on the car. Jim Hardy didn't do this. You hear me? Jim Hardy was out drinking beer with Pete Barnes last night. They drove up to a beer joint outside Glen Aubrey, and we got 'em checked in there till damn near 2 o'clock. I know about your little feud with Jim, so I asked around.
He could have done it after, too, Freddy said.
He was playing cards with Peter Barnes in the Barnes' basement until daylight. That's what Pete says, anyhow. Jim's been spending a lot of time with Pete Barnes, but I don't think the Barnes kid would do a thing like this, or cover up for someone who did, do you? Freddy shook his head. And when Jim hasn't been with the Barnes kid, he's been with that new dame. You know who I mean. The good looker. Looks like a model.
I know who you mean. That is, I've seen her.
Yeah. So, he didn't kill this horse. And he didn't kill Elmer Scales's heifers either. The State Farm agent says it was a dog-turned-killer. So, if you see a big flying dog with teeth like razors, I guess you got it. He looked at Freddy hard and turned back to Rhea Dedham. You about ready to go inside now? Too cold out here for an old lady like you. I'll get you inside and go back and get someone to get rid of that horse for you. Freddy stepped back, rebuffed by Hardesty.
You know it wasn't a dog.
Yep.
So, what do you think it was? What's going on?
He looked around, knowing that he was missing something.
Then he had it, and opened his mouth just as he saw a bright bit of cloth fluttering on the barbed wire fence near the stables.
You want to say?
There wasn't any blood, Freddy said, looking at the cloth.
Good for you. Farm agent decided not to notice that. You gonna help me with this old lady?
I dropped something back there, Freddy told him, and walked back toward the stables.
He heard Hardesty grunt, picking up Miss Dedham, and when he got to the stables, turned around to see him carrying her in the door. Freddy went over to the barbed wire and pulled the long bit of cloth from it. Silk. It was torn from a scarf, and he knew where he had seen it. Freddy began, it was not the word he would have used, to scheme. Back home, after he had typed up his report and mailed it and the signed forms off to the head office, he dialed Louis Benedict's telephone number. He did not really know what he would say to Louis, but he thought he had the key he'd been looking for.
Hey, Louis, he said. Hey, how are you? This is Freddy.
Freddy?
Freddy Robinson, you know.
Oh, yes.
Are you busy right now? I've got something I want to talk to you about.
Go ahead, Louis said, not very promisingly.
Yeah, if I'm not taking up your time. Okay, you know, about those animals that were killed. Did you know there was another one? One of those old horses the Dedham sisters own. I wrote the policy on it. Well, I don't think any Martian killed it. I mean, do you?
He paused, but Louis said nothing.
I mean, that's screwball. Look, isn't that woman who just moved into town, the one who sometimes hangs around with Jim Hardy, isn't she working for Sears and Ricky?
I've heard something to that effect, Louis said, and Freddy heard in his voice that he should have said Hawthorne, James, instead of Sears and Ricky.
Do you know her at all?
Not at all. Do you mind if I ask what the point is?
Well, I think there's more going on than Sheriff Hardesty knows about.
Could you explain yourself, Freddy?
Not on the phone. Could we meet somewhere to talk about it? See, I found something out at the Dedham place, and I didn't want to show it to Hardesty until I had talked with you, and maybe with, Mr. Hawthorne and Mr. James.
Freddy, I don't have a clue what you're talking about.
Well, to tell you the truth, I'm not so sure myself, but I wanted to get together with you, have a few beers maybe, and bat a few ideas around, sort of see what we can come up with on this.
On what, for God's sake?
On a few ideas I have. I think all you guys are just terrific, you know, and I want you to know if there's any kind of trouble coming your way.
Freddy, I've got all the insurance I need, Lewis said. I'm not in the mood to go out. Sorry.
Well, maybe I'll see you in Humphrey's place, anyhow.
We could talk there. It's a possibility, Lewis said, and hung up.
Freddy put his receiver down, satisfied that he had planted enough hooks in Lewis for now. Lewis was bound to call him back once he'd thought about everything Freddy had told him. Of course, if everything he was thinking was true, then it was his duty to go to Hardesty. But there was plenty of time for that. He wanted to think out the implications before he spoke to Hardesty. He wanted to make sure that the Chowder Society was protected. His thoughts went more or less in this order. He had seen the scarf from which the piece had been torn around the neck of the girl Hardesty called the New Dame. She had worn the scarf at Humphrey's place on a date with Jim Hardy. Rhea Dedham suspected Jim Hardy of killing the horse. Hardesty had said something about a feud between the Hardy boy and the Dedham sisters. The scarf proved that the girl had been there, so why not Hardy too? And if these two had, for whatever reason, killed the horse, why not the other animals? Norbert Clyde had seen a big form, something peculiar about the eyes. It could have been Jim Hardy, caught in a ray of moonlight. Freddy had read about modern witches, crazy women who organized men into covens. Maybe this new girl was one of them. Jim Hardy was fodder for any lunatic who came down the pike, even if his mother would never see it. But the reputation of the Chowder Society would be damaged if all this were true, and if it got out. Hardy could be shut up, but the girl would have to be paid off and forced to leave. He waited 2 days, anxiously waiting for Lewis to return his call. When Lewis did not, he decided that the time for aggression had come, and once again dialed Lewis's number.
"It's me again, Freddy Robinson."
"Oh, yes," Lewis said, already distant.
"I really think we ought to get together, eh? Honestly, Lewis, I think we should. I've got your best interests at heart."
Then, searching for an unanswerable appeal,
"What if the next body is human, Lewis? Think about that."
"Are you threatening me?
What the hell are you saying?"
"Course not."
He was flattened. Lewis had taken it the wrong way.
"Listen, how about tomorrow evening sometime?"
"I'm going coon hunting," Lewis immediately said.
"Gosh," Freddy said, startled by this new facet of his idol. "I didn't know you did that. You hunt raccoon? That's really great, Lewis."
"It's relaxing. I go out with an old boy who has a few dogs. We just go off and waste time in the woods. Great if you like that sort of thing."
Freddy heard the unhappiness in Lewis's voice, and for a moment was too disturbed by it to reply.
"Well,